Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Are you looking for a speed course in food history? I've got just the book for you. Stay tuned on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And if you have looked at some of the tomes, I have to call them tomes, large books on food history, culinary history, history in general, wondering how do we begin to research food history, not always an easy topic to find out about, it can be daunting. But today I have for you a brand new book, at least in the United States, that will give you an idea of what history is all about in terms of food. 4,000 years of history. It's called A History of Food in 100 Recipes by William Sitwell. And the British version has been out for about a year now, I guess. And today is the publication date. I think it's today, William. We'll find out. Of the American version of the book. And I have to tell you, it is delightful. It is academic. And yet, it is a pleasure to read, a lot of humor thrown in, and it really does give you a sense of where we came from in the world of food and how everything old is new again. And William is joining me, stateside actually, but on the phone from San Francisco. William, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Terrific. Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I have to say that, you know, a lot of people were kind of laughing and waving their hand about the book, saying, oh, well, it's just a humorous romp through, you know, through a serious topic. It is not a humorous romp. It is a romp. Yes, indeed. But it's really a serious work. And I commend you. The bibliography alone can give people a really good idea of where to go to start their research, I think. Congratulations. I have to say congratulations.
Well, that's very kind. Yeah, it was a long slog. Well, actually, it was quite a short slog. I wrote it in 6 months.
How? That's what I can't imagine. You were talking about different things that came your way in 2010. But, you know, I gave short shrift to you, actually, as the writer. You have been immersed in food culture as a writer and as the editor of Waitrose Kitchen, which, for those who don't know, it's a very popular British food magazine, formerly known as Food Illustrated. And you've been on TV food shows and radio. And as you said, you're a good talker, presenter. You said somebody who can't stop eating. That right there, I think, is the first requirement. So you have been immersed in food for a while, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm a journalist who ended up on a food magazine and realize that it's a wonderful subject for a journalist because food touches so many aspects of life. It's a great doorway into different people's cultures, and it's about politics, it's about economics, it's about culture, and it's about friendship, it's about sharing, fun, you know. So, you know, and also it's about chefs and crazy chefs, and, you know, I've discovered that we could break news stories by pitting one chef against the other. There's lots of great food rows you can have. You can create wonderful scoops, have coming up with polls in food. People have lots of opinions about food. Everyone is passionate about food, from the farmer to the consumer. It touches everything. So it's as a writer and a journalist, it's the most perfect subject. And also for me, the food scene in Britain, where I live and where I work, over the last 15 years, where I've been immersed in this subject, has been incredibly exciting. So I've watched, monitored, written, and engaged in a subject that has become, you know, really, you know, part of the national debate, really, in the UK.
And as it has here. And as I say, everything old is new again. I mean, it's not exactly anything new, but it has taken on, a position of importance, of more importance than it has for many years, at least in terms of people's what they're looking for in food and their the production of it and the growing of it, and people seem to be more concerned than ever with food.
Yeah, and it's slowly dawning on people that the what most people think is common sense really is common sense, in that, you know, it's a very important part of your health and well-being, what you eat, and also how you source that food is very important for the health of the planet. And I mean, the 20th century saw this extraordinary rise in the growth of consumerism and in sort of the processing of food and the manufacturing of food and the move to fast food. And I mean, there was an amazing guy called Clarence Saunders who invented the modern supermarket, really, in the States in the early kind of 19-teens. And he founded a store called Piggly Wiggly, which you've probably heard of, which is still going now. And he was an amazing man because he was traveling on a train from Indiana trying to work out how to deal with the inefficiencies in the retail trade at a time when, you know, you queued up for food and people in white coats served you, and therefore your staff were rushed at particular times of day and then had nothing to do with the rest of the day. And he, on this train, he stopped and he saw a pig farm and he saw a mother sow being fed by her little piglets. And he hit on the idea of self-service. So he opened stores where people could help themselves, and he called it Piggly Wiggly. And some might say that Clarence Saunders then unleashed this sort of mass consumerism on the world. But I mean, I'm sure it could have happened for other reasons. But subsequently, from the 20s onwards, we've seen the mechanization of food. We've seen people embracing new technology in their homes. And it took people like Francis Moore Lappe, famous Californian.
Right, diet for Barclay, a small planet. Right.
You know, to start saying, hang on a second, we need to think about the planet. We need to think about the conversions of protein from grain into meat and the inefficiencies in that, the amount of water it takes to raise cattle. And she argued for the vegetarian diet very, very successfully. And it's taken people like her and various campaigners to try and get the world to wake up and see the damage that we're doing with our obsession with fast food and processed food and the manufacture of food. So, you know, the last 100 years has been an extraordinary revolution. But you're quite right in that there's lots of things in the food scene today that people think are new, and there's nothing new. I mean, I went through quite a lot of Victorian cookbooks when I came home from an auction a few years ago from the London auction house Sotheby's, and there I found in a book called Castle's Dictionary, it's a dictionary of food, people talking about leftovers as a sort of new trend. And of course, here we are, you know, editors like me who edit food magazines thinking that, you know, leftovers is new and trendy, and of course it's not at all. Yeah. and also the cycles of publishing throughout history, you know, go in endless cycles, in that you know, people will go from trying to be incredibly authentic, and then someone will say, oh, that takes too long, so they then produce something that's really, really speedy, and then someone says, oh, that's not authentic enough, we must produce something that's more authentic and less quick.
Right.
And, you know, so you see over time the these cycles in publishing, cycles in food trends, and it's something that I wanted to pick up during the course of my book.
Well, I'm so glad you went to that auction and picked up those old books, those old cookery books, because it really did spark a terrific, as I said before, romp through 4,000 years, unless people think you jumped right in the 1900s. You start with Jean Bottero, even Mesopotamia, the foods of Mesopotamia, all the way up through Mario Batali talking about the food he cooks today in his restaurants. And the first, and it's not, and really the title, it's not 100 recipes necessarily, although yes, you do have sort of recipes, but it gives people the idea, 100 different things that you feel were, I guess, points. Is that it?
Yeah, that's right.
Points of departure?
I mean, I'm not going to start saying that I'm a fraudster and that I don't totally deliver what I promise. I mean, the book is called A History of Food and 100 Recipes. There aren't 100 recipes in there, but what I've done is I've stopped a particular point in history and have got as close to a recipe as I can, because I wanted to write contemporaneous accounts. You know, I wanted to show people exactly how food was being written about at a particular moment in time, and then not try and translate that for the modern cook, not try to update it, not try and say, okay, you know, here's a recipe based on that, which you can then go to your local market and deliver at home. I wanted people to read how recipes were written over time. And there were, you know, I needed to cover, for example, important moments in the development of bread. Now, bread, people weren't writing down recipes for bread until the sort of, you know, the 1400s, 1500s. So I stop at the Bayeux Tapestry, this famous tapestry that was produced after the Battle of Hastings in 1066, very famous English battle.
Right.
And within that tapestry, there's a section where you can see a bit of sort of outdoor catering, and you can see people making breads. And so I use that as a moment. And also, 1066 was a point after which we see the introduction of the hair sieve, which sounds bizarre, but actually it's very important because the hair sieve enabled people to refine the flour they were using, and it meant that people could then use a finer flour and produce much finer, whiter bread, which was seen as an amazing sort of status symbol.
Right.
And likewise, you know, I wanted to touch on the Vikings, their contribution to the world. But Vikings didn't write down recipes. I mean, when they were marauding through Britain, for example, they didn't stop before they pillaged and set fire to your house. They didn't stop to find out what you were eating and write down recipes. But what they do exist are the sagas, these amazing, this oral tradition of poems that record the various activities of the marauding Vikings. And so I use that as a moment to record a sort of fishy moment when I think it's Grettir the Strong, he's about to kill Eric the Red, and he goes off and buys a load of fish. And so, you know, and also like the first chapter in the whole book, I start in a tomb in ancient Egypt where there's the very clear depiction of how you made Egyptian flatbreads in around 1958 BC. So I got the food editor that I work with to look at the pictures I had and to transcribe from the wall of what was happening down onto a recipe. And actually, you know, it's not a bad recipe.
It's really not. It's not a bad recipe. I mean, it's amazing how very much like today's recipes, if you're going to mill your own flour, it is. And obviously they had some type of a sieve, even though it predates the hair sieve. But they were, and they do mention to remove the husks from, you know, from the finer parts of the grain. But that was an interesting story in itself. The tomb, because it was a tomb of a woman who was not, you know, an empress.
And that's right. It was very unusual. I mean, it's an unusual tomb, as you say, because it's a tomb of a woman, and there are very few tombs to women. So she must have been very important, and she was either the wife or the mother of what's called the Antifoca, who was one of the pharaoh's right-hand men. And so it's important for that, and also it's important because the paintings in the tomb are incredibly well-preserved. And, you know, the ancient Egyptians had depicted on the walls of their tombs the things that they wanted to take into the afterlife. And so obviously she loved her food, and she loved her bread. I mean, there are depictions of butchery going on. There are depictions of beautiful paintings of fishes and various sort of birds and so on. So she obviously loved nature, and she loved her food. So those things were depicted on the walls of her tomb.
All right. Well, you won me over when I saw that you did include two of my all-time favorites. One you've just mentioned, the Bayeux Tapestry, which I think is often ignored in terms of use for food history.
And culinary. Yeah, exactly. Because, you don't often see people talking about the Bayeux Tapestry when they write about food.
And William the Conqueror loved to eat. I mean,
so, for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, they had a pretty efficient and sophisticated outdoor catering, as you can see from various images on the tapestry.
Right, and the other one that you used was Hilary Sperling's writing of Lady Eleanor Fetteplace's Book of Receipts. Now, I don't think I've ever come across anyone else who has referenced that book, and it's always been one of my favorite. And she took this from a manuscript, and I was just talking with someone else the other day on the air about how manuscripts give us so much more than when publishing finally came about, because there are notes in the margins and it's more of a personal accounting of how to cook. And this is a delight. You know, Eleanor Fetteplace's manuscript of her receipts is just a delightful accounting of cooking. So much being passed down by oral tradition, obviously, and someone then finally takes the time to write it down. And And this was those two. I knew I was hooked as soon as I saw that you had both of those in your bibliography.
Yeah, what's interesting about Eleanor Fetterplace's book is that it is one of many that probably exist, certainly existed in a lot of English houses and probably across the States as well, because mother would hand to daughter her recipes from her grandmother, mm-hmm. and then they would write down their recipe. Mm-hmm. And so what you get over time is an extraordinary compendium of food across, you know, many decades, if not a couple of hundred years. And what's fascinating about Eleanor Fetterplace's book is it dates back to 1604. It wasn't until her sort of great-great-great-grandniece came across it that she decided to transcribe it and publish it as a book, a kind of low print. But for me, it describes rather interestingly the food and the culinary practices of the turn of the, you know, the 16th century, 1604. And she's got this fantastic recipe for crayfish. And, you know, 1604 was not a great year. You know, they had the plague. There were lots of, there was a lot of death going on. And, you know, what you get is a very clear depiction of how she ate and lived, you know, the ovens that she had, and also the progress that you see in food history, because before that period, there was a lot of medieval influences on food, with sort of sweet matched with savory, lots of saffron, almond milk, pottage, and so on. But she sort of moved on and sort of separate. You can see in her book separating the sweet and the savory, and you can see a sort of modern progression, really.
All right. Well, I like how you read between the lines in many of these references that you use, because that's so much of what we have to do in reading old texts, because it's not always spelled out directly. And so you have to kind of have an idea of what they're talking about, and you can get so much out of it. I want to ask you a few more questions about how you chose what you did when we come back after this short break. So stay with us.
I wish that I were twins, you great big babykins, so I could love you twice as much as I do. I'd have four loving arms to embrace.
This one's called I Wish I Were Twins by Plexiphonic on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Two hearts twice as true, what couldn't four lips do? When four ears hear you say that I'm yours, da-da-dum. I wish that I were twins, you great big babykins, so I could love you twice as much as I do. Twins, you great big babykins, so I could love you twice as much as I do. I'd have four loving arms to embrace you, four eyes to idolize you each time I face you. With two hearts twice as true, what couldn't four lips do? When four ears hear you say that I'm yours, da 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 da. I wish that I were twins, you great big babykins, so I could love you twice as much as I do.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Hi, and welcome back. I am talking with William Sitwell, a journalist and editor of Waitrose Kitchen, a food magazine in Britain, and a TV star. Well, Will appears on TV and radio, and William has written a new book called A History of Food in 100 Recipes. And just to give you an idea of the scope of some of his references, he does include Eliza Acton, Hannah Glass, Elizabeth David, Andrew Dalby, Jean Bottero, Cato, Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, Bartolomeo Scappi. The list goes on and on. You think of a reference that you may have used, and it will be there, I assure you. And, William, I'm not surprised, because you come from quite a line of literary relatives from what my reading in your background, so that you're no newcomer to research and writing and reading. Tell us a little bit about your family background in terms of being immersed in the world of words.
Well, my great aunt was a famous poet called Edith Sitwell, and she had two brothers, Osbert and Sacheverell. Sacheverell was my grandfather. He wrote over 130 books on poetry, music, and art, and his elder brother, Osbert, wrote a very famous autobiography called Left Hand, Right Hand, which basically portrayed a sort of dying period of the Edwardian life in England. And Edith was a very famous poet, partly because of the way she looked. I mean, my grandfather once said she looked like an altar on the move. She was always clad in sort of velvet gowns and amazing hats, and she had these beautiful long fingers that were adorned with incredible sort of rings, huge rings made out of amethysts and so on. And she was an avant-garde poet, and she never married. She had various sort of failed romances with people who were never going to marry her, probably anyway. And but she was a brave poet. She wrote a lot of poetry in the war, in the Second World War, depicting the Blitz and so on in London. And she sort of stood up against that sort of thing, which was a brave thing to do at the time. And I suppose she's probably partly mostly famous for a piece of work called Facade, which were very rhythmic poems, using assonances and dissonances and metaphor, and using language for its sound rather than necessarily its meaning. I would say she was, you know, she's an early white rapper. And I love her work. Her poems are the poems in Facade, which were put to music by William Walton, brilliant English composer.
Interesting.
Sort of move from the melancholy to the very fast and complicated. There's one called A Hornpipe, which is the first one, which goes, said, it's come to the drum, matter of Babylon, hobby horses foam, the dumb scudonosaurus rum, which the courses of the breakers, rocking horses, and with Dorcas, Lady Venus, on the settee of the horsehair sea. New arisen, Madam Venus, for a sake from Fark, in the fattened severed emperor from Zanzibar, who like golden bukas lay far Asia, Africa, Cathayo lay before that shelly lady by the fibroid Shah. Now, I'm not quite sure what that means.
Oh, I'm glad you don't, because I certainly don't, right? It is. I can see it being set to music. It is very rhythmic. Yeah. It's
very rhythmic.
Yeah.
And a bit like modern rap, where the sounds of the words and the pulsating beat of the music and the effect of that gives you a meaning which isn't necessarily, you know, linked to the words, you know, where the two can work together.
Right.
And I think she's an extraordinary... She was a very musical poet, and I love her poetry. So she was, her personality was extraordinary. I mean, the clothes she wore were extraordinary, and she wore these enormous hats. And she was once staying with my grandfather when Noel Coward was staying, and she went out into the garden, and she disappeared, and someone had to go and find her. And Noel Coward said she was found lost among the cabbages. She had such a big hat on, she couldn't see out, and she refused to take it off, so she was lost in the vegetable patch.
Well, you were obviously influenced by all these people who came before you in your family, because the book is as readable as it is informative. I mean, so often these books that try to cover a lot of territory, a lot of ground, are dry, and yours is the book is certainly not dry. It does move right along. It's very enjoyable to read.
That's kind of you. I mean, I think it's partly because I'm easily bored. And so... I kind of kept myself interested as I was writing it. So, and also someone who spent sort of years catering for sort of magazines for mid-market.
Got to keep them interested, huh?
You know, so I've got sort of tabloid instincts, so I use that as well. But I did allow myself to drift off a bit and have some thinking and a little bit of academic
study. Oh, you did.
Study.
And I think if somebody wants a good topical history, you know, leading them through the ages, I think that this is truly a respectable book to go to, because then they can veer off into what period that interested them the most. So my question to you is, how did you pick? I mean, it must have been a difficult decision, how to pick which stopping points, where along the way. What did something just stand out to you and really as, oh, this was a marker in history?
Well, I had a researcher that I worked with, and together, she and I plotted the scope of the book, and we decided that we wanted to basically cover off various areas. So we wanted to start quite early, start at a point.
Well, you started at the beginning. I mean,
so we start at the beginning. We start as early.
Why not just do like a thousand years of English food history? That would have been something.
So we kind of started as early as we could, and also I wanted to make sure that I was using primary sources, because mm-hmm. there's lots of mythology about food, and I wanted to make sure that I nailed facts. So, funnily enough, once you start investigating this subject, I found that the subjects, together along with the researcher I worked with, sort of popped up, and it was the best stories and the stories that most interested me. And then it was almost a case of me then arguing to myself and then arguing in the essay as to why this period was important. And so, for example, you know, you can't but help stop and analyze what the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes discovered in the early 1500s when he was conquering or discovering the New Spain, Mexico, and coming across that extraordinary Aztec leader Montezuma. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, Cortes brings back chocolate, coffee, as well as gold, turkeys, tomatoes, chilies, these amazing ingredients. And what's amazing is also to think of European, international food, what it was existing like without these things like tomatoes. And it's actually quite late that you get tomatoes mentioned. I mean, I stop at a guy called Antonio Latini, who was a cook in sort of Neapolitan Italy in the sort of early 1700s. And he produced a book where you have the first ever mention of the word tomato in a recipe. So basically, with my journalistic hat on, I found myself naturally stopping in various points. But then I also would want to write about the development of the modern supermarket, the development of modern contraptions in kitchens, uh-huh. the development of the phenomenon of the celebrity chef.
Right.
You know, who was the first celebrity chef? Marcel Boulestin is my argument, because he appears in an early schedule of the BBC in the 1940s.
Right.
And then also looking at who were the key influencers in cooking in the States, which is why I stopped with Alice Waters. You know, Mario Batali. I mean, Alice Waters, and as well as people like, you know, Francis Morlappe, mm-hmm. with the book we mentioned before. So really, once I started sketching out the broad brushstrokes, it was then a question of finding out, you know, what else I needed to paint the color in the dots, so that overall you have a history that then is a kind of history of everything that you have in your kitchen today.
That's right.
I mean, there were some dead ends I went down. Like, I wanted to write about the cheese grater, because I thought that'd be quite interesting. And if you look on the internet, it tells you that there's a museum in The Hague dedicated to cheese graters. And I looked and I looked and I looked, and I think that was a complete fantasy. So there were some cul-de-sacs that I found. I ended up in dead ends, and I stopped, and I realized that I'd been sort of wasting my time. And there were other areas that were much more fruitful. So, but as you say, I mean, I think in a way it's what's interesting is that I'm able to tell a history of the world through food, because food influences everything that we do. And so it's a quite fun way of actually enveloping oneself in history. And I'm not a historian, I'm just a scribbler. But I learned a lot on the way. And I sat in the British Library, this amazing institution in London, which has virtually a copy of every book that's ever been published.
Right.
And you can hold these precious objects in your hand, these ancient books.
I have visited the manuscript room, and it is quite unbelievable. Yeah, well, I was impressed because you even include some Chinese history in there, which most people, when they're writing about food history, they stick to Western development and don't venture into the East, the Far East. But you do have a bit on some of Imperial China.
And well, that's right. I mean, half of the world lives on congee.
Right.
So I wanted to work out where this rice dish had come from. And so I delved into the Book of Zhou, which is a pretty dense, thick official history of Imperial China. There's 24 histories of Imperial China. And the Book of Zhou is 50 chapters long and is the one that includes a reference to congee. And it's from sort of 636. And given the influence, obviously, of China on the rest of the world, I thought I had to stop there briefly during the period of the Tang Dynasty and look at who was eating congee, why they were eating it, and then reflect on the fact that, you know, obviously today people still eat congee. I think there's a museum dedicated to congee in Fangchun County in the Anhui province. So maybe I should make a pilgrimage there.
Yeah, and it was certainly worth mentioning.
It's not a dish that's particularly attractive to my palate, but I thought I ought to mention it.
Okay, so as much as I am impressed with your work in the book, I have to ask you a question. There was not long ago, just a couple of years ago, a project by the BBC and Radio 4 at the British Museum called A History of the World in 100 Objects. Is this... Did this have an influence on your book, by any chance?
Not just an influence. I completely ripped off the idea and then ran with it with food. I thought, if there's a history of the world in 100 objects, we can do a history of food in 100 recipes. And, you know, you can push it. I mean, someone else needs to write a history of war in 100 battles. Someone else can write a history of horticulture in 100 gardens. So, to me, it just seemed a neat trick. And funnily enough, Neil McGregor, who wrote that book, I saw him at a literary festival in the UK, and I showed him my book, and I got him to sign it. And I said, thank you for allowing me to pinch your idea. And he was fine about it. So, but no, he runs that famous museum in England, and his book is magnificent. And it just seemed a very nice conceit to use in order to study food. So I brazenly, unabashedly, without embarrassment, I nicked that idea and I've rolled it out.
Well, you've just opened the door for a lot of other people to jump on the train. So, well, as much as we hate to just limit it to 100 recipes, it's not really, because you do give us reference points and talk about history for 4,000 years, and anyone can really infer from that there's so many more subjects to explore and so many more recipes to explore. And you said yourself that this book is an investigation into and a tribute to the passionate people who have driven the story of food, its story, forward over the centuries. And I think you did it. I think you did a good job. And I'm still having fun with it. I have not read every chapter in its entirety. I tried to do a fast read. But another one of our hosts here at the radio studio walked in and said, "Oh, I love that book." He said, "I'm having such a good time with it." So there you go. You won us over. And it's certainly a credit to you. And good luck with the book in America. And welcome to this side and your launch of the book. And I hope to hear more from you. And thank you.
It's been a great treat talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Good. It's been a pleasure spending time with you, and thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.